Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
You know, lately I've been noticing people affirm that all of us human beings are afraid. Not only do I think that that isn't necessarily so and doesn't have to be, but my guest today has lived a life he never would have lived if he'd allowed fear to influence him. Instead, he stepped into a flow and ended up living something of a magical life, which is what he's here to talk with me about today. Hugh Brown is here to talk about his path from militancy to spirituality and from Harlem to heaven. Talk to me on either of our chats at emotionalpro.com and blogtalkradio.com, or call and talk directly with my guest, toll-free, 888-498-0570. Now, Hugh Brown started college in the riotously inflamed fall of 1967, already a photojournalist for the New York Urban League. In college, he became the president of the Black Student Organization, and over time became the founder of the first and only Black Art Directors Group of New York. He also became a Harlem community organizer, a world traveler, was accepted for publication by the National Geographic, started and managed several successful businesses, became a motivational public speaker, and a widely published photographer. In his book, One Less Rascal, Hugh Brown takes people on his mind-blowing and wonderful journey from militancy to spirituality, from Harlem to heaven. Hugh has worked with NBC and Saturday Night Live and has had experiences and made photographs of people like the Dalai Lama, Muhammad Ali, Presidents Clinton and Obama, and Richard Pryor, among many, many, many others. Hugh Brown is a proud and loving father. He's become an adept spiritual seeker, having meditated daily for the last 45 years. He's had to motivate people to aspire to a life beyond limitation, mediocrity, and stagnation, and to find their own inner remarkability. Hugh Brown, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Full Power Living.
Well, thank you, Eileen. That was wonderful. I want to meet me. That sounds great. We have to become friends, and you can introduce me all the time, because that was great. I'm so pleased to be on your show.
I kind of thought that it would be a great idea for us to start at the beginning. You know, what were you doing in Harlem, and what was life looking like to you when you started out? Because over the course of the program today, I'd like you to expand on that and show us how you developed your life so that it's become what you wanted it to be and so fantastic.
Right. Well, thank you. This gives me a chance to let people know a little bit about other worlds. And what I've discovered over the years is that where we grow up and around the people we grow up with, we think that the whole world is like that. And I was a child in Harlem, and I was born in 1948, and I start my narrative at 10 years old. I said, well, let me just begin my conscious story at 10. And for me, I was a happy child. I lived in a tough neighborhood. I had no idea that the rest of the world wasn't quite like my neighborhood. But Harlem in 1958 was part of, or is part of Manhattan, like it is, it is. Manhattan is 49 square miles, and Harlem is 3.3 square miles. But in that 3.3 square miles, we had between 400 and 450,000 people.
Wow.
So to give you an idea, I live in Santa Barbara now. So Harlem and now heaven in Santa Barbara, in a sense. I still love Harlem. Santa Barbara is about 49 square miles and has 100,000 people.
Wow.
All right? So the population density was one of the highest in, it was probably the highest in the United States. And we had very, very few wealthy people there. So it was a very intense environment, a very scary environment, and a very defeated environment. You know, the people didn't. For example, when I came to California, I met people that said, "Well, you know, we're Jack Kemp kind of Republicans," and I said, "Well, what does that mean?" They say, "Well, that means that we pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps." So I asked this fellow who was quite wealthy to tell me how one does that. And he said, "Well, we get some money from our family and we start a business." And I said, well, take the silver spoon out of your mouth. My family didn't have any money. So what would I have done? I said, "Well, then you get a loan from the bank." Well, I said, "Well, sorry, they redlined Harlem, so you couldn't get insurance and you couldn't get loans from a bank. So what do you do?" So you find yourself in a place that is the ghetto idea, where you don't have many opportunities. And the people, many of the people were, there was a sense of defeat there. Uh-huh. And when I was 10 years old, it was the summer, I remember, and I went into a corner store to buy a pineapple soda. I love those sodas. If those of you from the East Coast, they were called Good-O soda. And I walked into the middle of a conversation with a number of men, African-American men, and they were having a heated conversation. And I walked in and they said, "Here's an example. Who are you, boy? Who are you?" And I said, "My name is Hugh." And they said, "No, he's just another N-word. All you can do in this life is be black and die." And I was surrounded by that feeling and a lot of drugs. And I didn't participate in that. I didn't feel that. I felt that I was empowered, I was blessed, and I could do whatever I wanted to do. So part of my life has been, okay, I'm going to try to achieve as much as I can achieve, but also to give back to people, to defeat that sense of hopelessness, that sense of we can't succeed in this world. So that's what I'm trying to accomplish. So one of the major things that happened to me at 10 was, and I'm sure a lot of people out there will join with me, every day from after school, I would come home and I would turn on the TV and I would watch the Mickey Mouse Club. Those kids were so happy. They sang songs and, you know, unlike the other shows, where there were detective shows and there were, you know, M Squad and, you know, all these shows that had westerns and things like this. But these were kids that were having fun singing songs and riding fake horses. So, and then I was in love with one of the girls on the
show.
And that
Vermicello had to be.
Karen.
Yeah. How did you get from this place of despair and you're not going to go anywhere because you're a black male to going to college and then getting a job that sort of catapulted you into meeting incredible people? How did that happen?
Well, let me just finish with the Mickey Mouse Club because it was a very significant. Sorry, it was a very. I'll try to make it brief.
I'm sorry. I didn't.
Go ahead. I would beg my mother on a daily basis, right, that I wanted to be in the Mickey Mouse Club. And here I am 10 years old, and normally my mother would just sort of brush it off. And then she finally said, "Well, you can't be on the show because you're in California, and we're in New York." And I said, "Well, that's no problem. We can move." I mean, that's the 10-year-old logic. Certainly there's no problem in doing that. And then I don't know what happened that day, but finally my mother said, "You can't be on the show because they don't take Negroes."
Ah.
And that really hit me, you know? And it stopped me, very precocious child, from bugging her. And I thought, well, gee, what, you know, Mickey is black.
That's true.
So I went to the TV and I turned the channel, and every channel there were no black people. There was no Negroes on TV except for one guy that was on, I remember a show called William Bendix, and he was like Step and Fetch It. And then I realized there was a difference between me and the larger world. I wouldn't be invited over to Leave It to Beaver's house. So my eyes were opened. But I was determined to be judged on my merits. I said, well, if they feel superior to me, then put me to the test. You know, let's have a foot race, or let's have a mathematical test, or a test on history, or something like that. So I was feeling that I needed to be strong. So where did that come from? I think it comes from the soul. I think I've been blessed with inspiration and drive and so on, and I intended to use that. So I propelled myself out of that community and tried to, you know, I ended up going to college, and at that time in 1967, only 6% of African Americans went to college. And if I hadn't gone to college, I would have been in Vietnam. So I was lucky. So then in college, I saw that, for example, my world history course. Now, we scraped and saved to send me to college. And, you know, when you buy the books there, I remember my world history book was $35. And in that book, it actually said, and the book was written by Henry Steele Cominger. It said, slavery was terrible, but everyone agrees that little black Sambo was happy.
Wow.
And I just went through the roof. I said, we scraped and saved, and you're going to tell me that the past was, you know, slavery was, a, you know, people were happy. And you can hear that today, some people are saying that. So I was motivated. I started to organize students, and I wanted justice. That's all. I didn't want to hurt anybody. I just wanted fairness, and I was willing to go down in flames rather than to repeat this horrible past that we've come through, because all of African Americans, you know, their parents have experienced terrible, terrible experiences that I won't get into now. So when I was in college, that was to redress or to change the world, actually, to change the world. And
wow.
Unlike Don Quixote, you know, I was rescued because I met a spiritual teacher in my junior year, and he told me that if you want to, really want to change the world, you have to change yourself. You have to start with you. Let there be one less rascal in the world, and the world will change. So I titled my book, One Less Rascal.
Oh, that's where that came from. I hadn't been clear about that. So already as a junior, that would make you maybe 19 or 20 years old.
20, yeah.
You were learning that life is lived from the inside, and that when you change yourself, things around you change. Now, things did change around you, because when you graduated from college, you got a job, and I suppose there were very few black faces there, too, at NBC.
Correct. I was actually in my senior year, and a friend of mine who had worked in the radio business at the time as an engineer got a job at NBC. Now, NBC in 1972... it was the only entry-level position that they opened their doors to was in the guest relations department. And that had started back in the radio days when NBC was called the Blue Network or the Red Network. So they had a long tradition of NBC pages that worked in the radio studios. And then by 72, we worked in the studios bringing the people into the studios, watching them, also working with celebrities and doing tours. So my friend said, they're hiring at NBC, and would you like to make an application? There's a requirement that you have to have 2 years of college, which I was in my senior year, and you had to know somebody in NBC to recommend you. So he recommended me. And I went for the interview, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people there, and they hired about 50 people. And I was one of the lucky people. And you had a 18-month tenure there, and then if you went on in the company, you were an NBC employee in perpetuity, you know, or until you got fired. So I was lucky, and I got in, and I didn't get a job within 18 months, but they liked me so much they kept me on for 24 months, and then I worked in NBC Radio under the famous Jack Thayer, who became a friend of mine. He was the president of NBC Radio. So during my time there, I was really one of the few African-Americans in the company, and I met some of the executives and sort of, you know, the term is fair-haired boy. I wasn't fair-haired, but I got a lot of primo positions while I was there at NBC for 7 years. So during that time, worked giving tours, and also I got my friend Lee Comback and I got the primo job of being liaison between NBC and the celebrities that would come into New York for, let's say, Celebrity Week. So when they had the Match Game, What's My Line, those kind of shows, for a week they would have nothing but celebrities as the guests on the show. So we would pick them up at the airport. We had a limo that would pick us up in the morning, which was really kind of fun. I remember one day the limo picked me up, and my mother was with me, and she was pointing out to people while I got in the limo, "That's my son, that's my son," which I thought was really funny. And so that was what my life was like there. But that started a long history, I guess, in my life of encountering people that have done something that has been a little bit beyond, or quite a bit beyond, the norm. So celebrities and then real people of achievement. So I got to spend, you know, the day as a liaison with someone. So Eileen, you and I talked about my meeting with Rod Serling, and I am a huge science fiction fan. It's got me reading every day of my life. And I like science fiction because it talks about human potential and growth. And so here is one of the premier authors in our country. He had written A Requiem for a Heavyweight. He was the most sought-after playwright in our country at that time, and had so many shows, and including The Twilight Zone, which I was a big fan of. So here I'm so lucky that I get to pick him up at the airport, be in a limo with him all day, and, you know, take him to the studio, and just be confidant or aide-de-camp to Rod Serling. So during that day, I had free rein to ask him anything, as a friend of mine would say, anything from cabbages to kink. So I asked him, let me preface this by saying he was one of the most unassuming celebrities that I've ever met. He didn't require any special attention, and he was just very, very, very nice person. But I asked him how he got into writing science fiction, since he was sort of, you know, he had written Requiem for a Heavyweight. And he said, interestingly enough, that in the 50s and the 60s, there were a group of writers like himself who wanted to write about civil rights, who wanted to write about human rights, but they were running into obstacles getting those shows on the air. So the atmosphere at the time in that era was that if you wrote about civil rights, it wouldn't make it on the air. If you put a black person on the show, it wouldn't make it on the air. And if you did, like Ed Sullivan used to do, put blacks on the air, maybe one like Mahalia Jackson or some famous person, Mahalia Jackson, the singer, the gospel singer, the southern states would not air the show. So there was tremendous opposition. So he said we ran into that obstacle. So he said what we discovered was if we took the same story about human rights and we put it on another planet, the moral of the story would still be there, and nobody thought that this was a story about, you know, America, about human rights and civil rights in America, but the same moral came through. So I thought that was very interesting, and I wanted to make sure that I passed that along to people that, you know, this was the basis for his writing, and I don't think that most people having, you know, and then when you go back and watch The Twilight Zone and some of the things that he did, you will see what those stories really contained and his intentions.
We're up to our first break. I want to remind our listeners that One Less Rascal is the name of Hugh C. Brown's book. And we're going to find out more about people Hugh has met and photographed, including two presidents and Muhammad Ali, when we return here on Full Power Living. We'll be right back. How would you parent your child if he or she were a foreign exchange student? As a host for an exchange student, you'd have five main jobs to do. Those are the same five jobs important in raising kids. People around the world have used this approach to raise kids who are self-directed, make great decisions, and are immune to peer pressure. Get your copy of the Exchange Student Model for Parenting, written by me, Eileen Dillon, now available on Kindle. As a 41-year marriage and family therapist, a single, married, step, adoptive, and grandmother, I've got a thing or two to tell you that's going to lighten your load as a parent and help you create incredible kids who will become amazing adults. Go to Kindle.com and download the Exchange Student Model for Parenting today. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. First of all, thanks for being here. For 10 years, I've enjoyed bringing you conversations with people like Hugh Brown, who are working to help us all move through the transformation that's now occurring for us and our world. So please continue to tell your friends and family about Full Power Living. You know, you can subscribe to this series free on iTunes. And you can listen to our archives on emotionalpro.com whenever you have time. So thank you for helping us with our mission of sharing with the world the amazing transformative power of emotions. Next week, we're hosting another wonderful experience with the amazing Sonia Recknitzer, who's co-founder of Accessing Universal Intelligence. Remember that this is your opportunity to ask whatever burning question you have about your own life, and get powerful, clear, and truthful answers from your own higher self. You can learn more about Sonia at accessingui.com. And so remember that whether your questions about changes you're being drawn to make or relationships or children or illness or forgiveness or past pain that won't leave you alone, you can call in and ask questions of Sonia. And if you're shy about talking on the radio yourself, email your questions to me at Eileen, I-L-E-N-E, at emotionalpro.com by Wednesday, and I'll present it on your behalf. So invite anyone you know who's in pain or discomfort in life so that they can get immediate life-changing help from the very best part of themselves. My guest today is another very spiritual person, Hugh C. Brown, who's a photojournalist, a businessman, an interviewer, a seeker of transformation, and a motivational speaker who's author of a book called One Less Rascal. Where can people get a copy of your book, and how can they learn more about your speaking schedule?
Well, okay. Now, first of all, my book has not been released yet. And I'm glad that it isn't, because things have changed so rapidly. But they can contact me. The best way to contact me is either on Facebook right now, where I'll be giving announcements about upcoming talks and so on, or on LinkedIn. So it's Hugh Brown, B-R-O-W-N-E, in Santa Barbara, and the same on LinkedIn. So please join me there, and, you know, maybe you can contact your show and you will relate it to me. But lots of things are changing. Like, for example, yesterday I've been asked to contribute some of my work to Carlos Santana, who's releasing his autobiography coming up soon. So I was lucky enough to know him and photograph him, and at some of the important times in his career, in the 70s and beyond. So I'm including that in the book. The book is not finished. So this transition into public appearances has occurred very rapidly for me within the last 4 or 5 months. I decided to rebrand myself not only as a photographer. I had originally intended to publish a book of these people of achievement that I met with, and only to find that there's so few bookstores these days and people don't read books. So adding the story to the photograph and then talking to people about it on radio and television and making public talks was the best way for me to get the inspiration, share the inspiration that I've received. Now, as a spiritual person meditating on a daily basis, I feel like I've got a reservoir of peace, of light, of strength, and so on. And the thing that I need to do in the world is to share that. My spiritual teacher, his motto was, love God, serve man. So this is part of my spiritual discipline, to pass that inspiration along to all and sundry. So it gives me satisfaction in life, and that is my goal in life, is to have happiness and satisfaction. And anything that doesn't bring me happiness, that doesn't bring me abiding satisfaction, I don't want to do. So when I turned 65 in December, I decided that all I'm doing is going for satisfaction in life. And appearing on shows like yours gives me a great deal of satisfaction when I can pass that inspiration and motivation along to other people, because 5 minutes of inspiration propels you through your whole day and maybe through your whole life. So my meetings with, I've sought out inspiring individuals to photograph them and then glean from them what it is that has gotten them to this, you know, achievement, to this plateau.
Okay, so can you give us one or two people? You told us about Rod Serling. Who is somebody that you have been able to talk to that achieved a high plateau and had a really clear inspiration that would speak to most people?
Muhammad Ali.
Uh-huh.
I was lucky enough, when I was in college, my black students' organization, Muhammad Ali, to speak in 1968 at our college. Now, during that time, 67, 68, the Vietnam War was going on. Ali was stripped of his title because he was the man for all seasons and you know, decided that he's not going to fight or be used to fight this unjust war. A lot of us felt that Vietnam was not just, and he had the courage to stand up and say no. So he was vilified for that, and his championship title was taken away from him. So in order to support himself, he went on a speaking tour. And he spoke at my college, which was Iona College, I-O-N-A College, in New Rochelle, New York. It's a suburb of Manhattan, in a sense. So while he was there, I got to photograph him. And then years later, before his last Frazier fight, he had a press conference, and I was assigned to make an overture to him between my spiritual teacher and his manager, Wallace Muhammad. So, of course, I photographed him, I saw the press conference, and I spent several hours with him. He was kind enough to to let me sit with him while he was being interviewed by a whole host of other reporters, one at the time. And then he gave me considerable time to myself, and he autographed a book for me. But I got to witness him up close, and I was just amazed by him. First of all, when the press conference was on, here you have a group of, let's say, 100 New York press people, you know, reporters, journalists, and photographers, and these guys have seen everything, you know. But when Ali walked into the room, he seemed to have a shimmering blue aura around him. I've never seen anything like that. I mean, he was surcharged, you know. He walked in, and immediately these jaded press guys became little kids. And he got on the dais, and he spoke to them. And I remember one reporter said, "What happens if Frazier beats you?" And he stopped the press conference. He said, "Who said that?" And all of these guys turned into 12-year-old boys and pointed at this guy. And he said, "Come on up here. Who's going to beat me? Who's going to beat me?" So he had this charisma, and he was physically larger than I expected, because he's so proportional that when you see him on television, he doesn't look as imposing as he does in person. And when I shook his hand, my hand was engulfed by this you know, this amazing strength and size. So, and he was just so charming. And I have to say, he came on to every woman that came into the interview room. So he was, in a way, a lamb, and he was a tiger. He's been described that way, you know. So he was so inspiring, but he had integrity, you know. He had courage, and he stood for what he believed in, and he still does. So tremendous inspiration to me, and I feel very fortunate to have met him.
Right, and at such a young age, too. Well, now, when you and I talked in preparation for the show, I think you mentioned to me that you had I'm not sure if you said you had met Mother Teresa, but you did meet the Dalai Lama, and you did meet and photograph two of our presidents. And so I was kind of wondering, is there a difference? Now, here's Muhammad Ali. He's a fighter, and yet you describe him as having a tremendous amount of integrity and self-possession. Is there a difference in the qualities that stand out about people depending on what it is they've chosen to do, by your read?
You know what, that's an interesting question. I know I've been thinking about it since last night. Where I'm sitting at my desk, I have a number of favorite pictures of mine that are on the wall. And Isaac Asimov, the writer, is one of those people that I enjoy looking at his picture. I've met him in the 70s. Isaac Asimov, if people don't know, wrote 400 books on science mainly, and on science fiction. And he's one of the pillars of American science fiction, or science fiction in the world. And actually, the movie and the book, I, Robot, is, you know, it's from his work. He wrote I, Robot, and so on, and defined how we look at robotics and so on, and the future. So when I think of him, I think, here's a man that had a habit of writing 8 hours a day every day, and that allowed him to do these 400 books. He had an incredible curiosity. I think people of achievement delve into the thing that is their passion. They go for it. They, you know, like I write that, you know, I got inspiration on my couch, and I got up off my couch and I went around the world and I photographed important people, people of achievement. And to some people, it doesn't matter that I photographed the Dalai Lama or President Obama or President Clinton or whoever, but that I got off the couch. And I think the message is, get off the couch, get off your butt. You know what I mean? Use your courage. Get you know, if you love something, go for what you know is the best in your life. I saw something last month that said, and I do branding with people, and I've done that for a while, that what is it that you are most qualified to teach? You know, if you ask yourself, what is it that I'm most qualified to teach? Well, I started photography when I was 12. So that's 52 years, 53 years, you know. So I could talk about photography. I've meditated for 45 years, and I know a little bit about it. I see people writing books. I've meditated for 10 years now or 15 years. Well, for me, it's 45 years. It's part of my life. I can talk about that. But I can talk about how I've got to be in some of these places. So it's finding what it is that you are best at, you know, and then going out, going for it, you know, sharing it. It doesn't have to be sharing it with millions and millions of people, but stand for that in your own life, with your friends, with your family.
A lot of people are really afraid. When you go and say, get up off the couch, okay, what if the person I am is, you know, questions whether what interests me would interest anybody else, or what if I think I can't speak, or what if I think, you know, people don't like me? How do I motivate myself to get up off the couch?
Well, listen to me. You know, I've done it. If I feel that if one person can do it, any person can do it.
Uh-huh.
Now, you don't have to, you know, what can I say to a person that's frightened? Do it for yourself. Do it for yourself, and then share it. Share it with the people that are not going to criticize you at first, you know?
You know, that's a really good point. Now, I do writing, and I wanted to write since I was 16 years old. I did some writing, and then I let it go. And when I went back to writing when I was maybe 36 years old, I had a terrible time writing, and I couldn't write more than about 2 paragraphs. And I realized that it was because I grew up in a family where there was a great deal of criticism, and I was terrified that if I put my words on the paper and showed it to people, like published it, that I would be criticized. And so the way I dealt with that once I realized it is I did what you're talking about. I decided I have this desire to get this out of me, to put it down on paper, and I'm not going to worry about whether there's good syntax, whether I have the punctuation right, or whether it's even stated well. I'm just going to put it on the paper, and then I'm going to take what I write, I'm going to put it in a file drawer and leave it there until I'm ready to look at it. And I don't ever have to share it with anybody. And it took me about 4 months. And when I went back, I actually liked what I had written. And I took one statement, which was about something that had happened in college, and took it to a professional journal. And they published it without changing a single word.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, there you are. There you are. You did it. Do it for yourself. Do it for yourself.
Yeah, that's really a good point.
You know, but you have to examine your life. You know, like I said, what are you best qualified? What do people want from you? What can you add to the world? Each one of us is unique and is an instrument for your soul. There's a song coming through each one of us. In me, it comes across as a cello, maybe, and in you it comes across as a beautiful flute. But together, we make an orchestra. So each one of our voices are essential to the music of the world. So practice at home. Play your song to your children. Play your song to your neighbors. And then if you can, play it to your church group. Play it to your company. But every day you're singing a song. What is that song that you're singing? What is the message that you're broadcasting to the world? Practice at home and then play in the world.
Nice. That's a really great place for us to take our second break.
Okay.
My guest today...
I'll sing you off.
Oh, good. Is a motivational singer and speaker, Hugh C. Brown. You know, we're going to find out more about Hugh Brown and the people he's met. One of them is the famous track star and Olympian Jesse Owen. So we'll have more for you with Hugh C. Brown after these messages. You're listening to Full Power Living.
Eileen Dillon is a certified senior life mentor with Accessing Universal Intelligence. She's available to conduct mentoring sessions with you to help you understand, change, and evolve using the advice of your own higher self. You can be anywhere in the world. Sessions are conducted through Skype. For more information about these life mentoring sessions, fees, and how to register, go to www.emotionalpro.com and click on the mentoring link at the top. Get personally tailored assistance with your toughest life questions. Visit mentoring@emotionalpro.com today.
All right. Hugh C. Brown, B-R-O-W-N-E of Santa Barbara, look for him on Facebook and LinkedIn, is my guest today. And Hugh, one of the reasons I invited you to be on the show is I was so impressed with how many different people of influence you've... So I'm going to ask you, could you take a minute or a minute and a half and just list off as many people as you can think about that you've actually met and spent time with and possibly photographed?
Okay, sure. Well, the Dalai Lama, Muhammad Ali, President Clinton, President Obama, the great scientist Buckminster Fuller, a lot, and I fully understand that depending on the age group, people don't know who some of these people are. You mentioned Jesse Owens. I spent the day with Jesse Owens, and I mentioned that to people that are, you know, younger people, and they have no idea who Jesse Owens was. So.
Nice.
But to, you know, a larger demographic, people really know who the 5-time Olympic gold medalist was, who was in the 1936 or 38 Olympic Games. But I was going to meet Mother Teresa. I had a contact with her, but she died before I got there. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I was introduced to her through a fellow named Alan Durr, who argued Roe v. Wade, I found out the foundations of that were Reed versus Reed, which he won 2 Supreme Court cases. So I've met so many people. I've met secretaries, 2 or 3 secretaries general of the United States, and a whole host of writers and artists and musicians, Carlos Santana. I did John McLaughlin, the famous guitarist's first album, and then a whole coterie of people that are associated with these musicians, like Carlos Santana and all the people in his band. And, you know, there's just so many connections. I found myself many times in places where history is being made, or I seek out those individuals because I don't think that there is any reason why we can't meet them. So you name a person to me that has inspired you, and if it inspires me, I will seek them out and photograph them and hear
right.
their story.
Right.
So,
okay,
many,
so
many people.
How did you gain access to either of the presidents?
Oh, just being in the same place at the same time or asserting myself. So to give you an example, I'll do Obama. But when President Obama was a candidate, he came to Santa Barbara to give a talk. So as a, photographers are really historians because we capture significant events, and as the years go by, we see the significance of those events, and we are documenting, history. And it increases, photographing the Dalai Lama. He is a historical figure, and the value of the picture will appreciate every year in perpetuity. You follow? So, So I have a view on history and culture, and I pick out those events that are significant. And I think of the world as like a garden. You have grass, you have bushes, you have trees, but every once in a while you have flowers and you have fruit. So my eye, my intuitive eye, says the fruits and the flowers are significant, and I really do stop and smell the flowers. So I will take a picture of that. So now with candidate Obama, I knew that this was a very significant event. So I made it my business to go to the event and photograph everything, 360 degrees. I got in the reception line. I got to shake his hand and, whatnot. And then he went behind a series of circles that were his security. So here he is on the stage, a raised platform so that the crowd, outdoor crowd, could see him. And there's only one photographer and two Secret Service men in that, 20-foot circle around him. And then there was a circle of supporters around that, and then the general group, thousands and thousands of people. So I had gotten my pictures and felt that I had covered the event sufficiently. Now I'm covering it for myself, not for a news agency, so I have the copyright to the pictures. So while I was moving away, I heard that some woman had fainted, and President Obama said, please get the emergency service guys in. And I happened to be right next to them. So they walked in purposefully, and I had done volunteer work at the hospital. I knew the routine. So I just followed them in, and I went through their security, through everything. I was 5 feet away from him. I took a picture of the lady that had fainted. Then I turned around and I photographed him.
Uh-huh.
5 feet away.
Nice.
Now, I didn't spend much time with him, but I'm only 5 feet away from him, and I got the great photo of him as the candidate. So that's my President Obama experience. Clinton was a little different. But it's just having nerve and opportunity and chutzpah.
Uh-huh. That's really great. Now, one of the people you told me about that a lot of people would recognize is Mark Victor Hansen, who one of the co-creators of the Chicken Soup for the Soul phenomenon. I happen to know him myself because he's a member of the National Speakers Association, which I am also. But you were able to go to his home and photograph him with his family. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Now, Mark Victor Hansen with Jack Canfield wrote a little book called Chicken Soup for the Soul. Now, they've sold almost 1 billion copies of that around the world. It's known as Hot Chocolate for the Soul in Asia because they don't have the chicken soup idea. And I had seen Mark give a talk in New York, and I thought so much of him that I went backstage and met him. And he was very kind to me. First of all, he just gave me this enormous hug, and I was charmed by him. And when I came up with this idea of photographing people of achievement, I gave Mark a call. And he said, sure, let's do it. So in my process, I asked people to allow me to photograph them in their favorite place and to write on a piece of paper what has inspired them the most, and then give me the names of three people that they consider the most inspiring. In other words, out of a billion people in the world today, who has inspired you the most? Give me three names. So he wanted to participate, and he told me that his favorite place was writing at his desk early in the morning. So he starts for his morning, maybe at 7 or so, and he writes. So he invited me to come to his Newport Beach office, and this is when I came to California. So I got to his office early at 8 a.m., and I'm always on time, and because I'm so honored to meet these people. And I get there, and his secretary meets me and says, Mark decided to go home. And I felt, oh, my goodness, I feel bad. I got up at like 4. I couldn't sleep. And she said, no, he wants you to take the pictures, but he's gone to his home. He's decided that his favorite place in the world is his home with his family. So I was directed, he lives in Costa Mesa, which isn't that far from Newport Beach. And I get there, and I'm warmly greeted, and he's dressed so nicely. He's got this colorful sweater on, and, you know, his hair is fixed nicely. And I sit with him in his living room, and my process is to get a person at their ease. You know, my work is more revelatory than artistic. I'm not concerned about composition as much as I'm concerned about seeing who this individual really is. You know, not the book jacket photo. I want the real human being, whether they're smiling or sad or whatever. Who are they? So while I'm sitting with him and we're having a chat, his mother-in-law comes in and she says, Mark, where's George's phone number? And she's rather abrupt, you know. And he says, I'm talking with Hugh, and he's photographing a lot of well-known people, and he's photographing me, and I'm having a conversation with him now. And she says, I know you're having a conversation with him. Where's George's phone number? So this is nice. You know, it's like you can't be a celebrity in your own home. And after that, his daughter came in, and she must have been about 10 at that time. And she immediately goes behind him and starts twirling his thinning hair into devil horns.
Oh my God.
I didn't take the picture because I didn't want to put things off, you know, at that time. But I wanted that shot of her twirling his hair because it looked like, you know, devil horns. So I spent several hours with him, and I think I sent you the photo. It's really a beautiful photo of he and his family with his home in the background, and it's really indicative of who he is. He's a warm, loving man that he is. And he gave me the names of 4 people, and this is where my life becomes a lot easier, because the first person on his list was Moe Siegel, who started Celestial Seasonings Tea Company. So now I have the great honor of contacting this, you know, well-known corporate person, and I get right through the secretary, the gatekeeper, because I've been recommended by Mark Victor Hansen, who's his friend. Moe Siegel says, whatever Mark says, we have to do. My work is wonderful to be able to get inspiration from people and hopefully to pass it along to all of you out there.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Hugh, obviously we could talk for hours, and thank goodness this isn't NBC and we don't have to cut it off right, you know, as things happen. You know, so often we talk with people about troubles and the things they regret and what they missed, and it's really refreshing to talk with you about all that you've done and the opportunities you've had and the ways in which you've followed your heart and the ways in which you've learned to open up your world. And I know you're going to have a wonderful, or you are having a wonderful time going around sharing these stories with people. And I want to thank you for taking the time to be here on Full Power Living today and telling us all these fabulous stories. What a rich life you've had. And thank you for sharing yourself with us.
Thank you very much for having me on, and I thank the audience, and I need your help in getting my message out there. So contact me, please, and I'll be able to do more.
Okay. That's Hugh, H-U-G-H, C, Brown, B-R-O-W-N-E, in Santa Barbara. You can find him on Facebook and or LinkedIn. All right?
Yes.
Great. All right. So thank you, Hugh, and we'll look for your book, One Less Rascal, too. Write your most pressing questions down for next week, because I want you to get in line early by calling our toll-free number, 888-498-0570, and talk directly with Sonia Recknitzer. You know, I've had the amazing pleasure of listening to every one of the programs Sonia has done in the last 6 months, as well as knowing many of the callers, which has enabled me to see how accurate and clear her information is. I've been amazed. I know from talking with some of the people afterwards that their lives have changed dramatically and for the better merely by calling in and receiving what Sonia has to offer them from their own higher self. So do not miss this program next Thursday, April 4th at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, which is noon Eastern Time. You can get the help you need and want. Thank you, Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media, for your dedicated service as our Full Power Living producer. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
To Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.